quote, Brian 10 years ago, end quote, is just as valid and as intelligent a person as, quote, Brian today, end quote. And I don't think he'd take too kindly to you saying, quote, reaching out to leftists is a waste of time, end quote. And I don't either. Unless, of course, your claim is that you wish I wasn't part of this whole business at all, in which case, sure, I guess I'm really not worth your time. But fuck you. Fuck you for thinking you can decide who can handle liberty and who can't. Fuck you for marginalizing people that could potentially do a whole lot for people and for the quote-unquote ideas of liberty and anarchism. Complain about what I have to say? Baby, I'm not the one that wrote off an entire segment of the population. You are. Suck it. And suck at the goddamn rest of you that think the left is a waste of time to try and reach. I'm glad people in my past thought differently than you.
Because a friend's somebody you judge for yourself. Some are okay and they treat you real cool, and some mistake your kindness for being a fool. We like to be with some because they're funny. Others come around when they need some money. Some you grew up with around the way, and you're still real close to this very day. Homeboys through the summer, winter, spring, and fall. And then there's some we wish we never knew at all. And this list goes on again and again. But these are the people that we call friends.
Stephanie, welcome back to the studio.
Hi, thanks, Brett. Thanks for having me back.
And Brian, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks, Brett.
So we're picking up tonight for the first time in 2 months. That was our last release of our ongoing discussion series. We've had some time to reflect.
Oh, yeah.
I've thought about a lot of the things we talked about in the
previous
show.
I've done a lot of reflection, too, about it as well.
I thought I'd let you start, because when we were initially making the plan to do the next show, you were telling me you had had an experience. So I'll just say you've had an experience and now you're going to explain it.
Okay, sure. So we've done 3 shows about this so far. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, this should be the last show. Mm-hmm. Like we all kind of want to wrap up the series. I think I'm ready to move on. I want to get back to Conspirathon.
Yeah,
and some other stuff.
Absolutely.
It's been really interesting. You know, we got some positive feedback from people. A lot of positive feedback, actually, mm-hmm. but we also got a lot of negative feedback, and mm-hmm. and I listened to that. You know, I didn't want to just dismiss it, so I listened to every piece of feedback that I saw, and there were some moments on those shows that I wasn't super proud of. Mm-hmm. Definitely found myself in an awkward position last show because we were talking about cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. and you know, a lot of people didn't like that topic.
No.
And let us know. There was also a critique that that I had dismissed something that Ben Shapiro said because he was saying something about black people, and I said, oh, you know, I find this annoying that he's a white guy lecturing to black people about how their community is or something. And somebody said, well, you're dismissing his argument because he's white. And I thought about it and I said, yeah, I was. And that's not cool. That's not something I want to do. So there's that. So then I started thinking about, okay, the series is called Empathon, right? Mm-hmm. In reference to empathy. And empathy starts with yourself.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we've learned about when we've talked about it on School Sucks and other podcasts. The first place you got to go when you want to practice empathy is empathizing with yourself. So I thought, okay, well, what's going on for me around all this? And what's going on for me when I get sucked into, when I feel myself getting sucked into sort of like collectivistic thinking or getting away from principles of liberty and voluntarism mm-hmm. that I'm interested in. And there's a lot going on. So that was sort of the epiphany I was referring to, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Please.
So some of the things I came up with, and part of this was like talking with some friends about it too, because that always helps me reflect, you know, to get some feedback. And one of the things I came up with was, you know, just in the last couple of years, I've felt kind of dismayed because it has seemed like the liberty movement has changed and, you know, some people have gone just away from the principles of libertarianism.
Sure.
That used to be, I don't know, that used to be more prevalent, or at least it felt that way to me. And also at the same time, it was just like I had this moment where I sort of woke up one day and I looked around and it was like the 2016 election was going on, and You know, there's all this talk about like the alt-right and SJWs. And I just woke up one day and I'm like, wait a minute, I feel like I've just awoken and I'm in the middle of this culture war that's kind of going on all around me.
Yeah.
And everybody seems to be picking a side. And okay, well, now I feel like I should pick a side, right? Because it's kind of dangerous to be in the middle of a raging war and not ally yourself with anybody. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess I could do that and could remain independent. But then where are all the libertarians? Where are all the independent people? It seems like that group has really thinned out as well.
It's weird. It's like high school almost, or prison, where you better ally yourself with somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I really had that sense that it was dangerous not to pick a side.
Sure.
Did you feel that too at all at any point in the last, let's say, year or 6 months?
I talked about that in a recent show, actually, that like the animosity that you feel towards a certain group, or that I have felt towards the left, probably a lot of that comes from the fact that that's a younger me, you know, that's not to the, maybe the extremes of what we see today, but that being so pompous and so sure that I was right and that I was morally superior to other people, that generates a lot of anger for me. So when I think about like the visceral reaction that I had to a lot of what's happening in higher education. And it bothers me for a number of reasons, including like the long-term political implications of it. Yeah, I found myself like lining up at times with people that under other circumstances I wouldn't have aligned with, like Milo Yiannopoulos.
Right.
You know? Or that he wouldn't even have existed if it wasn't for that current situation. I found myself defending Trump to people.
Yeah.
Which is like unacceptable.
That's a wake-up call. Yeah, I had a similar kind of wake-up moment. Here I was. We just did this whole series of shows about leftist ideas or, you know, those along those lines. And then this whole Nazi punching thing started becoming a thing on social media, or I guess maybe in real life. But yeah, there's this whole thing where I guess Richard Spencer, who is like a prominent person who has Nazi rhetoric, white supremacist,
white nationalist.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to be, I didn't mean to bias that too much with the term I picked. But anyway, he's known for that, right?
Yeah, sure.
And somebody sucker punched him,
right?
And it became like a gif, and it became memed, and suddenly people online were laughing about it, and it was like the funniest thing ever to some people. But I didn't feel that it was funny at all. Like, I just saw that and I felt so disturbed because it was violence. And at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter who that violence is being done to. I was just so uncomfortable at laughing about it. It was just, I found it dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. And I was really not comfortable with it. And I thought, oh, crap, you know, this is not where I want to be in the midst of these sides that are engaging in all this.
Right.
So that was sort of a wake up call for me when the Nazi punch thing started going around.
Yeah.
And people had all kinds of justifications for it. And yeah, I mean, I can see some of those arguments, but again, just, I was so uncomfortable with that violence, and that's not what I want to participate in.
Right.
So, but then what's the answer? What do? Do you just sort of stand alone in the wilderness and feel like you don't have a team that you're allied with? I guess you got to get comfortable with that.
I don't know.
Kind of uncomfortable to do that sometimes.
It is. Or, you know, you can have more of a piecemeal approach. What seems to happen is that people take ideologies and they use them as lenses, right? So they're just viewing new things that happen. And I mean, I can say this, like, I'm not saying you know what I know people do. It's because I've done it. And you take in new information through an ideological lens because it's comforting to think that you can immediately make sense of it, immediately understand it, mm-hmm. immediately process it, and immediately explain it to other people. You know, it's the same reason why people love these news gurus. No, never mind.
Talking heads.
It's something like that. But people are making a living saying shit will happen. Come to my channel. You know, like Alex Jones is a platform like that. I'll explain it to you. I'll tell you what to tell other people.
Yeah. And that is comforting because it's uncomfortable not to understand something or not to be able to make sense of it right away.
Absolutely. Well, unless you embrace that. You know, my last two shows were with Thaddeus Russell, who makes me feel like I don't know anything sometimes. And I like that feeling, you know, mm-hmm. I like that challenge. And if you spend too much time in your battle station, you forget that you like that challenge, right? You become more like the battle station mindset, or I do anyway. And I'm kind of being dragged around more than I would like by the stimuli.
Yeah, but it's so hard to resist those things. I mean, I feel like the three of us here are interested in finding ways not to get swept up with the current of whatever's going on in the world, right? Of being independent thinkers and of, like, you know, just taking a step back and not reacting to everything right away. But I mean, even we do get swept up in it sometimes. I was getting swept up in it.
Yeah.
Right. And it took a conscious effort to like snap out of it, you know?
Yeah. Once a day I go to Facebook and I like type a post and I don't send it. I just type it out.
Really? What are some of the things you type but don't send?
They're not, you know, that goes to
Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Yeah. I know. I don't know. It kind of defeats the purpose if I then start saying them on the show.
Is that like the therapeutic technique of like you write a letter to someone catharsis. That you would never send or something?
No, I planned it. And if you look at my newsfeed, you can see like when one slipped through. But I do that like every day. I have a moment like that where I just go, this is me, sounds of me typing and making faces. And then I just look at it for a minute. Like, I don't want to bother anyone.
Yeah.
Brian posts more. It was interesting. Oh. I spent a lot of time on – because I was looking for a post from Brian's archives today. So everyone has a different style. Brian is more of like a – you seem like you're a go-to person. Like you're more of a –
He wants to be the Alex Jones interpreting the news for everybody.
No, but Brian's kind of like, because he's got his niche, he's kind of like a thought leader. So people want to hear him like riff on things like that. And I think we're just different. We just have kind of different brands in that way.
Like, yeah, I have a style that people expect and they want it, you know. And so I just kind of put it out there. But it's fun for me. Like that's kind of the differences. And you know, I mean, social media is an odd thing. Like, can you handle, like, a lot of people, it seems, can't handle not having the last word. I can type something out and just not care at all whatever happens to that.
Right.
You know, and I know that's kind of a rare thing. And, you know, maybe that's part of getting to where you don't get swept up in the current, is that you can just express how you feel and then you don't give a shit, you know, from there on. But, yeah, I can get that way, certainly.
I had a nasty one with my brother's wedding photographer last week.
Oh, about.
So he's, you know, just a Democrat, right? And he reads this post and he's like, I couldn't really follow what he was saying, but he's something like, the real problem is Republicans or something like that. So I just commented with a question mark, like I didn't understand it. And then he said something else I didn't understand. So I just said, all right, good luck with everything. You know, I was like, I don't know what to do with this. And then he started arguing with other people. So I came back and I really... Like it kind of left me just with a bad feeling that I was mean to somebody. Like I said, okay, if I can't reach this person, I'm going to at least make this memorable for them. They come into this thread.
So you were getting into the like punishment kind of mode.
Very much.
Yeah.
And they didn't know. I could objectively say they didn't really have a good grasp of the subject matter they were trying to discuss, but they were doing it in a way where they were really talking down to everybody else, mm-hmm. which was, you know, my other friends in the group. And so I came back and I said, could we get some clarity? Like, because I tied it to this thing that happened where these people who wouldn't bake a wedding cake were fined like $135,000.
For a gay wedding.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the accumulation of those kinds of things that drive people into the arms of, you know, demented right wingers, or it's partially responsible.
Yeah. The tricky thing is, like, on social media, can you guys ever recall a time when your mind was changed by a Facebook post? Like from somebody that was completely coming from a completely different perspective as you.
Nope.
Where their post is like, idiots be like, and then they say the thing that I think.
Yeah.
And I go, oh shit, idiots be like that? Oh, no, yeah. No, that never happens.
Yeah, no, me neither. I mean, I think my mind has maybe been changed or swayed by people who were already kind of close to what I thought, but just not quite maybe there, but not somebody who was on completely like the opposite side of the the park for me.
Do you remember like Columbus Day like 5 years ago?
Yes,
that guy, Brett, and there's this other guy named Brett. He was like a big O objectivist.
Yep.
And I posted something like, Columbus, you know? And he's like, yeah, Columbus was so bad who gave the Native Americans Western civilization and a modern banking system. What a terrorist, you know? And then all these people pile on this guy and he just is like flame throwing left and right.
Oh, and yeah.
Eventually he and I like talk privately, and when I don't like how something's going, I'll just private message them and be like, hey, is everything okay? You know, can we just settle this here?
Just go over here.
I've done that.
I don't have time for that. So, yeah.
But it depends on who it is.
Brian just leaves the conflicts festering and open. Social media posts, I don't think, are big mind changers.
Right, no.
Or influencers. Maybe there is some influence that goes on, but again, I think it mostly comes from the people who are already kind of close to you and are most of the way there, rather than people who are diametrically opposed. But anyway, if we're talking about like, you know, sort of what can we do to avoid getting swept up into the collectivist current, because that's what I'm interested in out of this. Like,
yeah.
Now that I've started to reflect more on it, I'm like, okay, well, what, you know, what happened there and how can I don't want to get pulled into collectivism of any kind, right?
Sure.
I see other people doing what I think is getting pulled in, getting sucked into collectivism, both on the left and on the right.
Yeah.
And I'd like to avoid that if possible by trying to stay true to principles, you know, in the libertarian principles.
Right.
And so how can we avoid getting swept up? And to tie it back to the title of the series, Empathon, I think two things that I've learned from nonviolent communication and studying empathy are that I think are really relevant to this are, one, you don't have to take anything personally. That's a big one. And two, you don't have to agree with somebody in order to empathize with them or understand where they're coming from.
Sure. Yeah.
So we could talk about those in more detail maybe, but those I think are the two things that I've written down and I'm going to keep coming back to. Because, you know, so many online conflicts and so much of the conflicts, like just that we see in the world today, whether we're talking about SJWs or the alt-right, are people taking things really personally that they don't, that is a choice. They don't have to take it personally. People getting offended by things, right? Mm-hmm. In a certain sense, it is a choice to be offended, right?
Yeah. And it's not to say like, I don't want to present the idea that if you're having a conflict with somebody on Facebook, that means like you're unwell or unhinged or something like that.
Sure.
You can do these things and be in control. I'm just talking about like my own observations from, you know, how I feel after I do these things or what I observe in other people who do these things. So it's not, you know, not making generalizations here. But it's not helping a conversation and it's not helping people, I think, with their own mindsets. It's a fake world, you know? It's an imaginary world. And I've spent...
You said this before off the air. Like, explain a little bit more what you mean by that.
Well, these are things that are really happening, but everything is magnified and polarized online. Mm-hmm. And I actually, having some of the conversations that I've had in the show and reflecting on them over the last couple months, it was really important for me to like kind of detach from that. And even some interactions that I've had online. So like over the last 5 or 6 days, I've just gone out and been more in the real world and been less online.
Yeah, and that I find that is really helpful for me too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is not, you know, this is not a breakthrough, but it's easy to forget to go out and do these things.
Yeah, we all need a reminder about that for sure.
And listen to people. Like I was in a restaurant this morning in Canaan, New Hampshire. And I'm just eavesdropping, just listening to the people around me at tables next to me. And they're like, oh, you know, that Bill is home from the Navy, you know, or whatever, you know. And it's like they're talking about Bill, somebody that they care about. It's like no one is wasting their time talking about I don't even know what's going on right now. I don't even know what's a big story.
Well, I guess the gay wedding cake thing, the fine about the cake.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hear people talking about those things. And it's like when these things are broached in real life, people almost get uncomfortable. Like, oh, we're gonna potentially ruin our time together, you know?
Yeah.
There's a magnification online. It produces this polarization. And for too many people, this is becoming the real world. It's like Adam Curtis, who's a British filmmaker, made this movie called Hypernormalization.
Great movie.
Yeah, yeah, we watched that.
And he talks about how like something isn't right with everything, right? but we don't know anything else, right? So we just kind of go with it. He talks about, I think he actually
compares it to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and he's not paralleling the United States to the Soviet Union, but he's talking about that same kind of feeling, right? Where this isn't, we all know this isn't going anywhere good, but we don't know how to change directions because we don't see what the alternatives are. So I think it's something that's an interesting struggle for people our age because we remember the world before this, you know, and now young people are coming up who've never experienced the world any other way, right? Like if you're 16 or 17 years old, or if you're a freshman in college, you might not have much of a memory of a pre-Facebook world.
No.
Of a pre-Twitter world. We know that something else is possible, but we also know we don't want to go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't want to go backwards.
Yeah.
We're not good old days type people. This is not the real world. But people are saying it's the best thing going. People get together. This is another played out observation today. And people sit together and they're on their phones because that's become more real and interesting than actually like, you know.
Well,
yes.
There's very good reasons for a lot of that, though, I think. Well, I don't know if they're good reasons, but they're reasons that make sense, I guess. You know, I mean, part of the reason that I think this – well, it's also persistent, you know. Like a lot of these ideas that you say you don't find in the real world, you know, like this polarization that happens, mm-hmm. I think comes from the fact that like – you know, when somebody writes a blog post, look, that blog post is there pretty much forever, you know, for all intents and purposes. And that sticks as to where, you know, the human memory can forget something stupid that somebody said, you know, even yesterday or a month ago or something like this, as to where the internet doesn't forget.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of what creates kind of the polarization, you know, that people experience. The other thing is that, you know, most people either live in a shitty part of a city. Or, you know, they live in podunk somewhere and life's just not very interesting. You know, I mean, it really, really isn't. And so, you know, this is, you know, that the phone or whatever else is this window to a world where suddenly, oh, things are very, very interesting, you know, and suddenly there's causes and there's all these other things that where you live, the little town that you live in can't possibly provide, you know, I mean, like it can't even come close. And so all of that becomes very attractive, even, you know, to the older generations, like you were talking about
and
all this. And I'm not saying it's a good thing. You know, I don't think it is. And it comes from, you know, people's lack of critical thinking skills. I mean, whatever the reason, wherever that comes from, where people can't realize, look, this isn't actually reality. Like this is kind of a, you know, an alternative reality almost that you've created.
Impatience, delay of gratification.
Sure. And then you have, you know, algorithms on all of these social networks that will just give you more of what you keep interacting with. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not even entirely your own fault.
Right.
Like at the end of the day. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I can kind of empathize with why people, you know, kind of fall into this stuff because I think there's, you know, there's reasons that they do. And it's stuff that just the human brain isn't ready for, you know, and I don't know when it'll ever be ready for it, if it's even supposed to be. One of my favorite like analogies for a lot of this, like for the internet in general, an analogy is an actual historical analogy would be in Rome where you had the aqueduct system and, you know, the aqueducts were made of lead piping. Okay, now this is amazing. There's all these parts of the world, much like how the internet is connecting, you know, disparate parts of the world. You know, all these parts of the world were suddenly getting water and getting, you know, sanitation and all these things, and it was changing people's lives. But because it was lead piping, it was driving them insane, literally. Like it was poisoning their brains, you know, they were nuts. But it's an incredible technological innovation, and that allowed for so much prosperity. One could say the same thing about the internet, but what if it's actually driving people positively nuts? You know, just because they, you know, they can't handle it. Sure, it's not like a literal sickness like lead poisoning would give you, but it's something else. It's a framing of the mind that can be just as harmful, you know, in like you said, in the long term.
Yeah, and you see this, like these algorithms are giving people information through thicker and thicker lead fucking pipes.
Sure, you know? Right.
I'm watching people like that I went to high school with drive themselves completely mad with what Facebook is feeding them. This narrow focus of the world that you know, Facebook is feeding them just more of what they're looking for. Then they're just constantly fed HuffPo, Slate,
right.
Salon, BuzzFeed.
And it's a problem because the way to combat that is like, say on Facebook, like, you know, like if you're following politicians, I don't follow politics, but if somebody does, follow them all. Like, follow all the politicians. That way, you know, Facebook doesn't see necessarily that you're looking for this and this, you know, reaction from it, right? But the thing is then your friends who might be liberals or maybe they're conservatives or something like this, they see, wait a minute, you like, you know, Jill Stein? What the hell's wrong with you? And then you start getting ostracized. So you can't even use that. You can't even use the tools available to try and combat that narrow vision of the world that these algorithms will give you without getting shamed, you know, for doing it at all.
Yeah, I mean, the only advice that I can give for people in my audience is, like, find at least three podcasts of people that you really disagree with and listen to them.
Good one.
Like, you know, I always listen to Bill Maher. I was telling you guys I found Chapo Trap House, which is a podcast that Thad told me about. And they're a bunch of, like, Marxist Bernie bros from Brooklyn. And, you know, they're witty and they had Matt Taibbi on the show and they're talking about the mainstream media and how dumb Democrats are. And it's like, oh, my God, you know, these people are Marxist, but they're not like drinking out of skulls.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are kind of afraid to do that sometimes, listen to things they think they might disagree with or read things they might disagree with, because I think maybe deep down they're afraid they might start to agree with it a little bit if they even read it.
Well, you start to – I mean, you can start to connect with it in ways that are important. And you say, okay, well, this is a human being. These are thoughts that this human being has. This person is smart. This is an interesting challenge that a smart person thinks differently from me, that not all people who think differently from me are fucking idiots.
Yeah, exactly.
Neat. Maybe.
That was what I meant when I said you don't have to agree with someone in order to relate to them or empathize with them or understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
If you write something or if I write something like an article or a book, like the more people that can read it and give feedback is – it just helps it get better.
Yeah.
Even if the feedback is harsh or negative, I mean, sometimes that's how you improve the most.
I like that when people are like that with me. Mm-hmm. I hate that feeling when there's like that placation, like, oh, good. You know, you did something. I appreciate that. And I think that is one thing that we do get a lot of in like the libertarian community online and otherwise is honest feedback. It might not always be the most diplomatic.
Tactful.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's like you contrast some of the problems that you've had with people online with conversations that I have like at some neighborhood get together where I try to explain who I am and what I do. And people go, that's neat. You know, good for you. How interesting. I'm just thinking of like all the things that I've been told. That's different, you know?
Oh, I get that too. Yeah.
That's different. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather fight with people who are just willing to be honest, even if they're not diplomatic about it. That's way more authentic to me.
Well, it's like also when you introduce yourself and say what you do, you're not asking for feedback about what you do. Mm-hmm. You're not going to change your career because someone at the barbecue says, oh, I don't think you should do that, right?
Is it interesting enough for me to keep doing it?
Right. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, I think there's an attraction to the fight. I mean, there's kind of, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, get somebody angry and you'll find the real person. You know, this is maybe more true in like Japan than it would be in America, but, you know, everybody's so damned polite that, you know, if you're looking, I mean, I think we're all kind of looking for authenticity in each other. And with a lot of people, really, you don't get the real goods until, you know, there's a little bit of maybe some anger or something behind it. Not saying that that's a good thing, but that seems to be culturally conditioned to a degree.
Yeah,
so
I kind of like half agree with that. Like,
sure.
Conflict can be a way to bring out authenticity.
Have I gotten you angry
yet? No, okay. Not yet.
Okay.
That's later. Right. Authenticity can come out when there's conflict, but it's not like a guarantee, right? People can still be really inauthentic during conflicts. And also authenticity can come out without conflict.
Oh, of course it can. Absolutely. Just I don't know that a lot of people like – I mean just like Brett was describing, you know, everybody's like, oh, that's nice, you know, and that's this. And like you're obviously not getting a very authentic response to what they think
well,
about it.
Well, right, because it's like obviously they're thinking like that they don't approve or they're like – they have all kinds of questions. But they're just saying that's nice, you know.
Right.
They're not really saying what their face is betraying that they actually think.
Yeah, I think there is some truth though. To even if it's not conflict, there's an authenticity that comes through adversity.
Yeah,
and I think that it's realized in the self, and you can realize it in other people as well. But it doesn't have to necessarily be conflict. I mean,
no,
sometimes
it
can be some kind of hardship. You know, you confide in somebody about something that it happens that way too.
Sure,
but it does seem hard to move beyond those sort of superficial relations with a lot of people. And one of the things that I liked about the libertarian community the barrier didn't seem to be there. It was like we're enough alike that we could be honest with each other. And I was really confused by it when I first started hanging around with people in New Hampshire. I said, "What's wrong? What is wrong with me?"
Tell me more about that.
I felt
like a specific example or something.
I think it was more like the social awkwardness of other people.
Mm-hmm. It made you uncomfortable.
I'd go someplace and I'd be myself, and like my jokes wouldn't land. You know, I'd say something that was like totally a joke, and people would say, "No, no, no, it's actually like this."
You know, oh, just like went right over their heads.
Yeah, like that. It was a joke. And I remember there was this one guy, and every time I said something, he would look at me like I was the most adorable 5-year-old.
It's the eyes.
It was something. It wasn't threatening in like a sexual way.
Nah.
It was like kind of condescending. So, but I'm rambling about that. I just say that my point was that I prefer uncomfortable authenticity to the kind of superficiality and aversion to conflict. Like, people would rather not have discussions if they feel like they're going to wander into dangerous territory, while a lot of people in the liberty community are seeking that, you know, because maybe they don't, they have that same feeling that I do. They have that same kind of repulsion to inauthenticity as mm-hmm. well. And if sure. they can, you know, I want to have conflicts, and everyone's trying to avoid conflicts with me. So
yeah.
I'll go have conflicts with my own kind. There's a safety in that too.
Or what about just like intellectual stimulation, right?
Exactly.
When you're arguing, you're thinking yeah. of your thinking.
Yeah. People, you know, I was all pissed about how people were behaving in the Facebook group a while ago. And I posted some angry thing about it. And a couple people said to me, you know, I do get value out of doing this. I find it to be a learning experience. And I found the same thing. I since our last recording, I got into it with a group of SJWs and Hillary supporters and academics
where
on Facebook.
Okay.
And I invested like an hour a day for 4 days.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
And I screenshotted the whole conversation, and it was amazing.
What did you like about it?
All right, let me tell you the story.
Yeah, I'm curious about this.
So this girl, who's a couple years older than me, she grew up right down the street. Mm-hmm. Her and my dad were like best friends. Her dad and my dad were like best friends.
That was
all
weird.
Buddies. They even looked exactly alike. It was funny. So
okay.
This was the neighborhood I grew up in. But she is like a hardcore Democrat, Hillary supporter. Mm-hmm. Like every view I really have a problem with, this girl fully embraces. And she posted about – her post was, "Okay, everybody, privilege checking exercise. Talk about how your privilege gave you unearned advantages in the world today."
Oh, hell, that'd annoy me.
And dudes started saying like, "Well, I'm white and a male. So, I mean, you know, it was such an easy day for me. I mean, what could I possibly have for problems?" And I thought that was like real – I don't know, really icky. And my brother, my poor brother, he goes, "What is this privilege? What are you talking about? Like, I don't understand why you're using this word. Can someone explain my privilege to me?" Which was like not what I would have asked this group of people to explain things
to me. Was he really genuinely curious, or do you think he was like trolling?
He and I have talked like at dinner before about how annoyed he is by this girl. Mm-hmm. So I think he was like partially trolling, but he didn't know what he was getting into
mm-hmm.
because he just sees like – he's like, "Hey, I'm a Trump supporter, and if somebody likes Hillary, they're dumb." He had mentioned to me he was annoyed by a bunch of her posts, mostly around Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But this is now after the election, and this hypervigilance hasn't dissipated for this girl, mm-hmm. right? All of a sudden, there's this pile on 40 people lecturing my brother.
Wow.
Talking down to my brother, saying, of course you don't understand, but we're going to be patient with you, and we're going to explain it to you, and you poor stupid thing. You know, I mean, that was the tone. So I got involved, and I just started asking about the premises. I forget, there was a couple of terms that I asked them to clarify. And I said, "I don't think what you're saying makes a lot of sense if we're not clear on what these terms mean." And they said, "That's just semantics." And then you could start to see people filing out until the 40 people who were talking to my brother, it was just like one person left. Even the girl who posted left the conversation. So now it's just me and this one guy.
Okay.
Who, you know, basically admitted like they're just people in favor of state socialism and this was a path to it. You know, that was the impression that I walked away with.
Hmm.
There, I mean, I'm going to block people's names out of this, and I'm going to post it in the AV club. I think because is that unethical to do as long as people's names are blocked? If it's a public conversation,
I think that's fine. Sure.
Yeah,
I really think it's very instructive. But I have a folder full of screenshots.
So what would be the point of that? To prove that leftists are all just deep down really about socialism?
No, I think that it was. It was the tone of the conversation, how if it was like almost a piranha attack, if it's a person who is incapable of defending his or herself intellectually, but it's cockroaches scattering if a person can.
Mm.
The whole conversation was just infuriating, like reading lists, like people telling me books to read. I said, tell me your ideas. Tell me what you think. Tell me your thoughts. And no one could do that.
Just to be clear real quick, the right and libertarians and anarchists, they do that too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean,
absolutely.
And they're so bad about everybody. It. It drives me nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
But the piling on, I mean, I think that's a real thing. Like I've definitely seen that even in SJW groups, right? Somebody will use a wrong term or say something that's off kilter, off color, and people will just pile on. And then sometimes they get embarrassed and they delete their comment or something. And everybody goes, nope, no dirty deleting. You have to leave up the record for people to see what you said and then see you thinking about it. And
shame town.
Yeah. 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 So I can see what you mean about that. But the original post, like, I don't know about you guys, but I don't think there's no value in like thinking about how the circumstances of your birth have brought you like unearned advantages.
I would be annoyed by the way it was sometimes. Worded, like so, privilege extra practice or what was it?
Privilege checking. Okay, so that phrasing bothers people. Why? That's one of the
it
things.
Sounds like school
privilege.
Not the privilege part. I mean, like I'm okay with that, but like just the way that you described it.
You think
Brett,
it
like,
sounds condescending?
Yeah, it sounds like okay. Here's homework, kids. You know, and I'll be like, no.
Well, you don't have to do that homework.
Right? That doesn't mean it wouldn't annoy me. Like,
well, I objected to the word, and no. I wanted to have a conversation about the word privilege. And what do you know about the origin that term coming into the identity politics or social justice parlance?
Well, there was the essay unpacking the invisible backpack of white privilege or the invisible knapsack of white privilege by Peggy I'm sorry, I can't remember her last name. It was about the concept of white privilege, and it just lists like a bunch of things that, you know, it are different if you're a white person versus a, for example, a black person.
Right. Do you know like the origin of that, like the year?
Yeah, it was in the 1970s, and she was an academic at, I believe, Wellesley College or somewhere that in there.
So what I've noticed just in my interactions with people who are more of the mainstream left, mm-hmm. the longer you talk to them, the more their goalpost moves towards the 50-yard line and the lower it gets, and the more yours moves into the stands behind the end zone. Just a general pattern of conversation. In the 1960s, from the reading and history that I used to do, the writing of the time was like really powerful as far as social movements went, was about lifting people up. People had been, in some cases, it's the term is way too widespread in use today, but people had been oppressed. Mm-hmm. And oppression was used with precision, not in a way that trivializes the word or trivializes people's experiences. So the left came up with plans to deal with the fact that some people were disadvantaged, and it took shape as the Great Society. And it was a catastrophic failure that trapped generations of black people in poverty and all kinds of other problems. And then when it's clear that it's a failure, there is no talk of uplift anymore. Now there's talk of knockdown, right? And even though—
Well, the only talk of knockdown I hear is from people who criticize like privilege, like people like you. Who don't agree with that term privilege. Like, or the criticism is that it's trying to knock everybody down instead of uplift. And yeah, I mean, I guess I can see that, but I just have a different perspective on it. Like, it seems like a self-growth kind of exercise, a self-awareness exercise mm-hmm. to me, to think about ways in which, you know, I was lucky. I have advantages by being just born in a certain a certain way. And it doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, sabotage myself to make myself worse off.
Right.
It just means I'm aware of those. And then maybe I'll be inspired to just take that awareness with me throughout life and maybe use it to help other people. I don't know. You don't have to do anything with it, just to be aware of it.
I don't think the concept itself is a huge problem. It depends on the prescription that follows and the ability of people to defend themselves when those prescriptions are given to them. That's when it becomes...
I guess I just don't see... I just had trouble seeing the prescriptiveness in that girl's post. Like, she said everybody write about it. And now I wouldn't... For example, I would not participate in a Facebook thread like that. I wouldn't want to write about my privilege on Facebook, you know. I would like to think about it for myself.
Yeah.
And not share that with anyone necessarily. Just use it as a genuine self-awareness thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to share it to do that. Maybe that was it, because if you share it, you're going to get shamed or something. Or if you share it and you can't defend it yourself, you're going to get shamed.
Right. I mean, the point that I try to make to these people is I don't think you guys care about any of the things that you talk about. I think you say things that make you feel good. And you don't care if they're true or not. And when people – and this was done very slowly over a long, long conversation. When people force you to question, you know, the veracity of the things that you're saying, you will just put up walls to keep them out so you can continue to say the things that make you feel good. You don't care if they're true or not. And this is – like I see a lot of this, and I certainly see this from the mainstream political left.
Sure.
I got very angry in this thread, and I actually did resolve it. I did read – I took reading suggestions. I was reading Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah. Like someone actually came into the thread and said, wow, I can't believe a Facebook thread actually got resolved. That was how it ended. But this guy, you know, he basically said something like, yeah, this social justice stuff is really useful to move towards a more like equitable distribution of wealth kind of thing. You know, I mean, I don't think he knew who he was talking to. So I'd be like, oh, yeah, it is really useful. Yeah, you get like you pull on people's emotions and then you sell them socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I called him out on that and he left the thread. But then he came back. It was a wild ride. I really found it to be very educational, and not just about like these people, but like about myself.
What did you learn about yourself?
I actually felt like I was being kind of manipulative. I would type something and look at it and say, that's not nice enough to keep the conversation going. So I would change like mm-hmm. one mean word for like kind of a neutral word. Just because then I said, I'm going to do something with this. I'm investing all this time in this. I'm definitely going to present this somewhere. So I just wanted to see how long it could go. And
so you learned that you enjoyed participating and drawing it out?
I kind of did. And that I was manipulating. I was almost using like nonviolent communication to manipulate people. I was doing exactly what Jan Ervin accused nonviolent communication of being. You know,
wow.
I was saying, I understand. And then I would tell a story. No, I'm serious. And then I would tell a story from when I was a leftist. I was kind of almost like taking on Thaddeus Russell's positions to keep like a closeness enough. Like, oh, I totally understand what you're saying because, you know, in the 1960s, the Black Panthers or something like that, you know, like I know enough from having been in that world that I – yeah, I don't know.
So you were doing the thing that you just complained about, which is being inauthentic. And
absolutely.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. It was kind of like a performance. Well, wait a minute. Was I being inauthentic? That's tough to say because I definitely was in the thread because I had said there's major problems with you people. And then I was just kind
anytime it starts off with you people.
What do you mean by you people?
Problems with you people.
It's not going anywhere good.
Right. But no, I don't know. I don't know. I felt like I was tempering my responses to keep the conversation going, mm-hmm. basically.
So you were like testing to see how long you could keep it going and to see what would continue to generate responses.
Right. But as soon as I started questioning their premises, there was only two. It was me and maybe one or two other people who would talk to me. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, you saw from 40 people who were ready to pile on my brother down to two.
Mm.
Almost immediately.
Wow.
Like within five or six comments.
That's interesting.
We could go through some of it sometime, but
I'd be intrigued to see it. Yeah.
There was a Colbert, the late show, the Tonight Show, whatever the Colbert's
doing now. Yeah.
Yeah. He had a Black Lives Matter guy on. I think his name was DeRay McMackison. Maybe I'm wrong about the name. But the conversation was interesting. It's like they started talking about privilege, and then they started talking about Stephen Colbert feeling bad and guilty mm-hmm. about his privilege. And then before you know it, they're talking about reparations. And this is just a pattern that I see. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like privilege, emotion, economics.
Yeah. So. I don't think it necessarily has to follow down that path, though, because you don't have to feel guilty about it, right? What is there to feel guilty about?
I mean, that's a very good question. I don't think there's anything for people to feel guilty about.
Right. You didn't choose to be born as who you are. You could choose to be ignorant of it or to keep perpetuating the systems of oppression, or so-called, once you know about it, right? That might be something to feel regretful about.
Well, what would be an example of somebody perpetuating a system of oppression?
Oh, I don't know. I don't even know. I'm just saying I don't think you have to feel guilty about it necessarily.
Right.
A lot of people go there, right? Like there are a lot of white people who feel guilty about being white, yeah. right? And there are a lot of people who want white people to feel guilty about being white.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean you have to feel guilty, right? You can think about the concept. You can acknowledge that, yeah, there are some advantages to being white in American society that other people who aren't white don't have. And then it doesn't necessarily have to follow that you then start feeling guilty.
Right. It just seems like there's – with a lot of what I see, there seems to be a package deal.
So like anything, it's you take it piecemeal, right? You can, you take the elements that you agree with, right? Like maybe acknowledging that there are advantages to being white in the society. But then you leave the guilt and you leave the reparations.
Yeah. See, like I almost feel like I'm falling into a kind of thinking that I criticize the left for. It's like we were talking
about
Milo
that.
And fat shaming. Mm-hmm. Milo – says, well, I do fat shaming because these people who are like healthy at any weight, they're dangerous. You know, they're like people are going to listen to them and then they're just going to think they can go out and get obese and they need to take responsibility for the people that are listening to them. And then Milo has this Twitter altercation with Leslie Jones and there's this nasty pile on her and he's like, oh, darling, how could I possibly be responsible for all these people? They're just following me.
Right.
You know,
right.
So complete double standard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing that I always hated about the left is, you need us because everyone's an idiot, right? Everyone is stupid. Lucky you. Now we're here and we'll scientifically manage the world. It's kind of been their, you know, their move for 100 years in different forms through the progressive era and into like control of speech today. But you want to think that like my counter to that is people are smart enough to, you know, engage with the world on their own and they don't need your guidance. But now I'm kind of, you know, I'm thinking about what you're saying and it's like, yeah, okay. So you tell people about privilege and then it's up to them if they want to take it piecemeal or not.
Right.
But the people –
but you're saying you don't think people can think critically like that and unpack it and take the elements?
I'm thinking the context is really important. This isn't being presented to them in social sciences and higher education like it's a buffet. Like you can have awareness of privilege but mm-hmm. you can leave guilt.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have any economic prescriptions.
Yeah.
You know, it's like 1, 2, 3 package deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the presentation that I've seen.
I can agree with that.
Yeah.
And that's a problem because, yeah. I mean, there are lots of package deals, not just on the left.
Sure.
There's lots of dangerous package deals, right?
I agree. Yeah.
Sometimes you don't want to find out the rest of what's in that package.
Right. Exactly.
Well, but then I guess, like, are these people that accept this package deal, you know, or go down the road that you described, you know, where it's what, privilege –
privilege, guilt,
and then economics,
reparations,
or reparations, whatever.
Or socialism.
Yeah. I mean, can like, are these people unsavable, quote unquote? You know, like, I mean, are they worthless to even like try to engage? I mean, it seemed like you had a positive, or I don't know if it was a positive engagement. I haven't seen it, but you said like it had the, you know, the Facebook thing that you talked about. It had a resolution of sorts. I mean, this is where, you know, for me, where Empathon was. You know, I think kind of trying to go was like, you know, are these people, you know, are these people like, is it not worth the time to try and talk to them? Because that's a narrative that comes out quite a bit, is that don't bother talking to the left because they're just going to use like the tactics you've been describing, or they're just going to, you know, like pack hunt on you, or, you know, there's going to be something like this. I mean, you know, what do you think?
Well, the ratio from that, that the experience that I had in that thread, it was 40 to 1, right? It was 40 sure. people who said, well, fuck you, fuck this guy, bye.
Right.
And when I say 40, I'm like everyone who commented against my brother, plus everybody who liked the comments, like I'm estimating.
Yep.
But what I'm saying is basically everybody disappeared when it was a question, like question, what do you believe and why?
Sure.
Everyone was gone. When it was lecture, the person who appears to know less than you, everyone was excited and had plenty of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't a promising ratio. But it's a good transition too, because I said in the Speed and Politics series, you know, I was one of these people. And
right.
that's part of my animosity towards them today is that like, ew, I was kind of like that. At least I had that unearned moral superiority, and it actually helped me transition into libertarianism. Because libertarianism is that all day too, if you want it to be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, unearned moral superiority.
Oh, absolutely.
So I said in that show, you know, consider that maybe that's somebody like me, you know. And then in a later show, I said, I don't know if I stand by that anymore, because mm-hmm. me in 2006, the world wasn't as divided. And, you know, you talk about these algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
Like there weren't algorithms narrowing me into staying into that, you know, way of thinking forever. But that
right.
that is much more of a problem today. And I'm thinking, if you think about the context of the time, I don't know if it's the same, because you had the same story, right? And somebody said to me, you posted about this. Because I said that in the second show, and they said, Brian posted something about this. You should see what he wrote. But then I didn't. And then I looked for it today and I couldn't find it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I could read it.
We were around
wanted,
the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I would actually.
I mean,
while you're looking for it, I just want to make one quick point. I wonder how much package deals contribute to that division, because I see people, I see both sides. Like, for example, what you talked about, Brett, the package deal of privilege, guilt, reparations.
Mm-hmm.
I see some people who accept that whole package deal as a package. And then I see people who reject the whole package deal.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas I said, yeah, I agree with number one, right, that there are advantages to being white in American society and disadvantages to not being white. I don't agree with white people should feel guilty or there should be some kind of reparations, economic policy. Right. But there are people who say, oh, no, I don't. I reject the whole package. I don't even agree that there's advantages to being white.
That's an interesting question, because like, are the advantages to being white contextual? Right. Or are they universal?
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're contextual. But most of the context that we find ourselves in American society, a lot of them, it is advantageous to be white.
People, especially people on the alt-right or the Spencer crowd,
mm-hmm.
would say, no, those are now like being white and male just means you're an endless punching bag politically and socially.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start pointing to a lot of the things that occur in entertainment, like recurring themes in television shows. And I think about watching TV when I was a kid and you had like strong dad characters.
Oh, now it's the dopey dad.
Good luck finding a strong dad today in a television show.
Yeah, I've heard all those things. Sure. I mean, they point to media and to the, you know, just general attitudes that people have, sort of disparaging white people, I guess, or using them as the butt of jokes. Especially white men.
It's not even controversial to do it, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Also, though, like if you look at demographic trends and income and things like that, you know, white people earn more money. That's like a big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a huge advantage. And I mean, now all these things start to get really complicated. But the point I was trying to make was just I wonder if some people would feel as much of a need to debunk those narratives and statistics if the other conclusions weren't attached to them. You know what I mean? Like if it wasn't a package deal of...
If it stood alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would they feel such a need to say, oh, no, actually white people have it bad in society, right? Or men have it bad. If there wasn't everything else attached to men have advantages or white people have advantages, would people feel such a need to argue that men, in fact, do not and white people do not have advantages? And I don't think they would. I think all those other assumptions being wrapped up in it creates that division and creates that polarization even more.
I think the part of the problem is the imprecision of saying in society. You know, mm-hmm. if you said in the tech world or in corporations, and then you said this group, has either an advantage or a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. I think that would be more precise, right? But when you say men have advantages in society, I think what happens in the head of most men who are not just like, you know, flying around in helicopters and, you know, throwing money up in the air, they say, well, I can think of lots of ways where I feel disadvantaged. So it's kind of alienating. Mm-hmm. And then so their response is to double down when they say, okay, well, that's stupid because I feel alienated and I feel like that's untrue. So they say, you know who's really good at good is like women, right? And then women hear that and they would probably – I could imagine being a woman and saying, that's not how
What are you talking about? And especially coming from a man, he's trying to tell me what my experience is like.
Right. So, and this was like the problem with like a lot of these identity issues is it's just like this crank that pushes people further. It's like the opposite of a vice. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn it and people just move further apart in ways that I don't know how, because it just seems to be like almost an exponential problem. And then more people pile on and the noise just gets louder and the acrimony grows. So I think that it seems like these conversations lack detail. A lot of people perpetuate these stories and they don't even care if they're true or not.
What stories?
The gender wage gap is a messy one, that it was 20-something%, you know? And no one – it doesn't matter if that's true or not. I think all that matters is if people say it and repeat it and think it. And they don't say, okay, well, yeah, sure – if you take all the men in the country who work and all the women in the country who work and you add up all the men's salaries and you add up all the women's salaries, you've got a 25% difference. There should be like a question 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I think people just hear the outcome of, you know, finding one and they say outrageous, injustice, inequality, mm-hmm. right? But there's a story there why that number exists. And it doesn't tell anything, you know, that – adding up all the men's salaries and all the women's salaries and you have more money for men, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, obviously it's a lot more complicated than that. But again, like, I don't know. Are people looking for simplified narratives or package deals?
They're looking for simplified narratives, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's an issue. I mean, I don't know how we could get people to think more critically or be more piecemeal about things or look more in depth into certain issues. But...
Well, in tough economic times, I mean, who has the time?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point.
Yeah.
Who has the time? But I mean, maybe people who listen to this podcast are interested in that. I'm interested
Absolutely.
In it. Yeah. I think we all are. But anyway, sorry, Brian. I wanted you to get a chance to read your post.
Oh, that's all right. So
you found it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I had it up. Yeah.
Brett was looking for it. I mean, I'm assuming this
is I'm assuming this is the one they're talking about.
Yeah.
And a good chunk of this, no doubt, was in response to some of the response from previous episodes of Empathon. This is actually dated February 2nd.
Okay.
So, you know, but it's more than that. I think it kind of speaks to a lot of what we're going into here. So, and it has a little bit of length, but I'll make it entertaining. So, all right, confessions time. That's how the post starts. Before I was this wild and wordsy anarchist that you know and parentheses some people and parentheses love, do you want to know what political persuasion I was? I was a Democrat, balls to bone. I was a leftist from a huge family of leftists born and bred right in New York. While I was in the military, I came across some libertarian ideas, but it wasn't really until 2007, 2008 that I finally, quote unquote, got it. The libertarianism and then anarchism finally hit me and I never looked back. And I wasn't looking for libertarianism either. It was introduced to me by people who thought it was worth the time to talk to a staunch leftist about it all. And here's the admission. I get absolutely fucking livid when I hear or see people saying that reaching out with the quote unquote ideas of liberty to the left is either always or on the whole a waste of time. Livid. Every time I hear that, all I can think is, quote, Brian, you are not worth my time, end quote. That's kind of the main point of it, but I can read on a bit.
Yeah, read on. Okay. You're very clever with your posts. You create lots of opportunities for people to get upset, maybe even about the wrong things.
I am a master of
you're like it's very Trumpian almost.
Wow.
I'll try and take that as a compliment, but all right.
It is a compliment. Yeah. It's clever.
Yeah. So again, Brian, you are not worth my time. That's what I hear. So reading on, because 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been worth your time because of something that I was a part of course, that being leftism. Oh yeah. You're a piece of shit that isn't worth the Facebook post you typed. And that's referencing people that, you know, say it's not worth reaching out to leftists. How else should I interpret your nonsense? And look, I'm not a perfect person. I've done hundreds of things I'm not proud of, but, quote, Brian 10 years ago, end quote, is just as valid and as intelligent a person as, quote, Brian today, end quote. And I don't think he'd take too kindly to you saying, quote, reaching out to leftists is a waste of time, end quote. And I don't either. Unless, of course, your claim is that you wish I wasn't part of this whole business at all, in which case, sure, I guess I'm really not worth your time. But fuck you. Fuck you for thinking you can decide who can handle liberty and who can't. Fuck you for marginalizing people that could potentially do a whole lot for people and for the quote-unquote ideas of liberty and anarchism, or at least some people tell me I add value to their lives. So when a bunch of fucknuts start spewing that, oh yeah, I get mad about it, and I'm going to fucking say something about it because you woke up the peaceful dragon. Complain about what I have to say? Baby, I'm not the one that wrote off an entire segment of the population. You are. Suck it, and suck at the goddamn rest of you that think the left is a waste of time to try and reach. I'm glad people in my past thought differently than you.
I thought you said there was something about Tom Woods.
Oh, I cut it out.
Oh, all right.
I said suck at Tom Woods.
Suck at Tom Woods. Said,
that's the post.
Name of the episode.
I'll stand by that because, you know, and he actually responded to that. And my posts are public, so,
yeah,
you know, deal with it, people. Like, there's no privacy involved whatsoever, you know. And he said, yeah, if somebody told me it was a waste of time to reach out to the right, I'd, you know, respectfully disagree. But he's one of the guys that says this, you know, that it's not worth it.
He was an email that I read, yeah, originally, yeah, in the, and I opened that series, and that was what I responded to. And then, you know, and I agreed with what you said. And then the only thing that really changed for me is like, well, is that, are we past that window, you know? And that's very cynical. So tell me I'm wrong, you know, but
the Overton window. Yeah.
It, well, just, the world seemed more fluid 10 years ago as far as like, I'm just trying to think about a person like moving from like a hard left position into libertarianism today and like what that process, like I sat and I just thought about how it happened for me, maybe how it happened for you just based on what I knew, even though we have very different stories, even though they happen around the same time. Mm-hmm. Just thinking, how much harder is that today? I'm not saying it's impossible. And anyone who says never talk to anyone on the left is like, that's a missed opportunity even just for, you know, your own intellectual challenge.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's even more than that. And I understand that, like, it's easier to talk to people that are like of your – more of your persuasion, you know, more of your ilk. If you come from the right, sure, it's easier to talk to people from the right because, you know, you've got similar background, similar traumas, right?
Similar vocabulary.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and I really can understand that. But like the thing is, and again, kind of the main point there is that every time I hear that it's a waste of time to talk to the left, I hear, I am not worth your time. Not saying you, Brett, but just, you know, in the abstract. Mm-hmm. And if that message alone is out there, I mean, how many opportunities are you killing? How many people are you emboldening? Oh, libertarians think I'm not worth the time? Oh, I'm going to be an even bigger leftist. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to go all the way. You know, screw this. Trotsky, here we go. You know, I mean, like that's what I think can kind of happen. I mean, so, you know, if this problem is a lot of this polarization, a lot of, you know, a lot of not accepting nuance, not even willing to look into nuance, well, it's because there's these hardcore statements out there that these people aren't worth – they're not worth the lick. You know, they're not worth taking a second to even deal with.
They're othered right away.
Yeah. They're instantly us against them.
You feel
them.
Alienated by that statement,
sure.
Right?
And maybe the left does the same thing, and I'm sure they do, where they say, don't talk to libertarians and all this stuff. But then, well, you know, how about whatever happened to Better Part of Valor? You know, and
I don't think they have a problem with recruitment. They don't really need to recruit libertarians,
true.
Right?
True.
Yeah, they've got a steady stream.
Yeah.
It's funny the way they talk about libertarians and like how immediately like – in their conversations and just from like listening to like lots of left, like political left stuff, how quickly that association is made to laughing at people dying because you're libertarians, like as they laugh as people die from not having blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, from right. Starvation. Well,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. But you
not
know,
having welfare. Yeah.
A lot of times those things can be venues, like a really famous video, or at least I consider it famous. And I've seen a lot of people respond to it is Ron Paul and Morton Downey Jr.
Oh,
you
yeah.
remember the Morton Downey Jr. show?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Drug war.
Yeah, exactly. It was all about drugs. And so, you know, all of the leftists in the room just instantly start attacking, you know, kind of his positions on drugs and all this other stuff. Even though Ron Paul, you know, one could say that he has the logical high ground. I guess maybe the claim could be made. And it's like, well, you see, that's a problem with the left. And I'm like, no, that's not really a problem with the left. That's a problem with the venue. You know, you're on Morton Downey Jr. for one. Like, you got to expect that, like, this is by design.
Yeah,
there's supposed to be these arguments. It's like Jerry Springer, you know. And so that's, I think that speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about in this episode, you know, is that like a lot of times just these venues don't lend themselves to allowing people to get into nuance, to getting out of the package deals, to getting, you know, to actually getting to critical thinking. And it's by design that they don't, you know, but then people go out there, you know, they go out into the real world and they walk around with this idea. It's not worth talking to leftists. It's not worth, you know, talking to this. It's not worth talking to this kind of person. And when really maybe it's not even necessarily the person or maybe even not necessarily the ideology. It's just the venue sucks. The venue is, you know, it's not there to allow for anything remotely like critical thinking.
And we're watching it like spill out into the real world. You remember how there used to be like a real line of demarcation between online behavior and real world behavior?
Sure.
And now it's almost like in the last whole political season, you see the kinds of people don't care that the barrier's not there anymore. This has become the real world.
Well, but I don't know that that's – I don't know that that's so new because like I think of like a Howard Beale in Network. You know, in the movie Network where he gives that whole speech saying – and where he's talking about television. Replace the word television with Facebook. It's the same shit. You know, where he's saying it's like, you know, you think like the tube. You act like the tube. You drink like the tube. You dress like the tube. It's like we're all you know. It's like you think your own lives are unreal and you think what's on the television's reality. And you know, he's telling them like, no. He says, you know, we're the illusion. You're the real thing.
I'm trying to think why that would be different. But you're right. That's a really good – that's a really good parallel. And that was 40 years ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I don't, you know, I don't know that it's that new. You know, I get it, and it's still accurate what you're saying, but I don't know, you know, that Facebook and like the internet, a lot of the stuff in the online world, like there's this merged reality that you're dealing in.
Yeah, it might be like sort of ratcheted up a little bit now because, like,
TV, it's definitely more pervasive.
Yeah, like TV is like a. I don't know. Like you're interacting with the TV, but like your whole social network might be outside of it. But online, especially like Facebook, social media, like all of your friends are on it too. And they're on it at the same time as you are. And it's not just like you're interacting with a screen that's feeding you stuff. It's like going multiple directions and everybody you know is on there too.
Yeah. And it's almost like so the television is this abstract kind of foreign thing that sucks you in a certain way, and you get one level removed from reality. Mm-hmm. But then this internet thing is almost like, you know, in the one hand, you're watching some kind of, you know, you've got one window with some kind of porn that's something you're never going to see in real life. It's animated, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you're into. And then in the other window, you have Facebook open, and that's unreal. As far as like the quality or the nature of the interactions, but these are people you've seen in real life, right?
So it's almost extra like, confusing.
Yeah. But it's also another level of removal. It's interesting. I don't know why did I bring up the porn thing? That was completely irrelevant.
Story would talk about it, Brett.
The story would have worked fine.
Well, porn is a great example of how like people get distorted images of sex and like what their ideas about sex become further and further away from what real sex is like.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy. Let me tell you, every porn that's like mainstream, like one of these mainstream company makes, the setup for the scene, Julie and I talked about this, is like some woman who is just based on looks alone out of the dude's league. Mm-hmm. But boy, does she want to fuck the dude. And the dude is like, I don't know. We probably shouldn't, you know?
Really?
You're my friend's sister. I mean, isn't that weird for us to fuck? That's like every single scene is like that. We can't do that. No. What are you doing? And the girl's like, come on. I'm 21 and fit and you're 40 and...
Oh, God. Yeah.
Not fit.
It is unreal. Because, those situations pretty rarely happen in real life.
Right.
And I'm not – I just want to clarify, like, I'm not saying I'm anti-porn or, like, I think it's bad or I'm opposed to it or anything like that. I think it can be great, but you have to always keep in mind that it's fantasy. And it can be like, read a book, right? That's fantasy, too. Rewatch a TV show, that's fantasy, too. But when it becomes your whole entire world of that's what sex is for you, and then you get so bored of real-life sex that it's not even – that's no real life sex is no longer sex. Sex is only like porn sex. Then that can become a problem. It can become something that affects your life negatively.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just thinking when you said that about books, like in the 19th century, conservatives were warning people about the dangers of reading novels.
You know, yeah. Don't read Balzac.
Yeah, don't read books or don't read fiction. You know, it's bad. So it's like every new medium goes through this phase to degree.
There's some religious groups that, you know, warn women about the dangers of reading too many romance novels and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's ringing the devil's
doorbell.
Doorbell.
So, yeah, I mean, like escapism can be found in many different ways. Drugs, you know, food. Mm-hmm. Porn, internet, whatever. Like, it almost doesn't matter what it is. It's just you always have to keep a perspective and try to have a grip on reality at the same time.
Right.
You have a grip on your dick with the other hand. You gotta keep one hand on your dick, the other hand on reality.
That's we need to get that as like a PSA.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Always keep one hand on reality.
But I think political discussions are like that too. You have to keep a grip on reality and check in with yourself and say, okay, does this matter?
Yeah.
Like you say, is anyone going to remember this so-called great point that I'm getting all worked up about writing and spending all this time on a month from now? Probably not.
On an issue that's forgotten 2 months from now.
Right.
Cases. Yeah.
Is it going to change anything? Does it actually matter? Is it impacting me negatively to spend this much time on it or to get so worried about it? The answer to that one is usually yes for me.
Right. Sure.
So, yeah, I think that's what keeping a grip on reality looks like when you're engaging in political debates on Facebook or tempted to.
I wonder how much of this is just about a comfort in conflict, right? Because real change, like really doing things that are going to change things, that means discomfort. You know, and it's kind of like the ugly thing. Like a lot of people in the liberty movement talk in very revolutionary type ways while they try to build meaningful lives for themselves. And, you know, most revolutions were kind of prosecuted by people with nothing to lose,
mm-hmm.
you know. So
yeah,
it's like people have found a comfort zone where there's that conflict or discord, but it's in a very kind of safe arena.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a great point.
Yeah. Sometimes I worry that people, I wonder at times if like particularly like people in the liberty movement or something like this, not to say that they don't actually get out there and do things, but that a lot of times people, conservatives, I don't know, pick your group, that they're not so much scared of like the ideas maybe that say the left or SJWs or whatever are putting out there, but they actually see them on TV and they get scared to death that, wait a minute, they're actually doing something. When a lot of them are not. I mean, how many people are keyboard warriors, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times the keyboard warriors that's really what they're terrified is that someone that is actually out there doing something and maybe they feel like they have to get out there and do something. And they're so afraid of that, that they just start typing away as fast as they can. Oh, these people are terrible. Oh, no. These facts aren't right. Blah, 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 blah. I don't know. I mean, I'm just putting that out there. We can move on to other things.
No, I think that's a possibility. You know, one of the difficult questions is kind of something that has come up in this conversation, and I was thinking about this when I was going through your Facebook today. There's an interesting contrast that I realized from doing these shows where you've talked very critically about, like, the West, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And do you share those criticisms?
I don't – that's too broad. I have to
– Western civilization, Western values. Is that still – that's very – it is very broad. It's kind of a problem.
I still don't even really know exactly what that means. But yeah, I think I would criticize some people's sort of lionization of, quote, Western values or Western civilization.
Do you think there's value in these traditions? Do you think
like
it's –
like family – talk about family. You'll disagree with
that. To some extent. Do you think these were building blocks? The things that people figured out that became the problems that people solved. And now obviously there's great costs in you know, some of the things that have happened over the 2 years. There's huge costs. Oh, I don't even know if I want to say this. I'm going to say it. And
all right.
Maybe I'll regret it. Do you think we have the luxury of these criticisms because of work other people have done that came before us? Like imagine living without electricity or reliable medicine or sanitation and these problems getting solved. Like, I think about that sometimes and I almost think like every complaint that I have is a luxury, you know? Every criticism that I have of the way anything is just because I have time to have it, because I'm the beneficiary. And it doesn't mean like hooray slavery, you know? It's right. That doesn't come with it. But is there a way to kind of parse the good and the bad and appreciate the bad or appreciate the good tradition that came before us, you know?
Well, so I feel like I'm kind of hearing the John Adams argument of, you know, I have to study war and politics so that my kids can study economics, you know, and math and all these other things. And that way their children can study art and all that. Like, they're supposed to be like this progression. You've got to do the ugly deeds so that the next generation can be built upon to where that they can have the luxury to think about art. They can have the luxury. You know, this is an argument that he had in France, that John Adams had in France.
Yeah.
Know, like, you know, what do you think about the art and everything? He's like, well, I don't have much time for art because I'm trying to build a country, you know, and I don't buy it. You know, I get that maybe like my ability to post on Facebook, you know, is a byproduct or direct product of whatever Western civilization, and like we said, whatever the hell that means, that's what allows me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tough game to play because it's always playing, well, it could have been this way. It's always a what if, you know, because then I can say, well, what if Western civilization never came into being? What if it turned out like this? What if it actually ended up being better? What if?
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough to – it can be tough to answer that. But yeah, I guess I have the luxury to think about – you know, I have the luxury of thinking about politics, you know, of like having political opinions. I have the luxury of, you know, having the time to, or the, you know, the brain space.
You guys are really thinking about your privilege.
Well,
privilege.
Yeah. But, you know, to have the bandwidth to like, to even, you know, think about this stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, for me, what is, you know, what are the principles? What are the, I don't like the word rights, but what are the liberties that a human being has? Do these things stand in contrast to them? Yeah. A lot of times they are antithetical to these liberties. So it doesn't really matter, you know, for me, like whether I'm benefiting from it, you know, either directly or indirectly, what matters is it's wrong. You know, like it's not okay. It's not.
What are you guys actually talking about?
Like, what is
like
not
what
okay?
Specifically. Are you talking about?
Well, okay. Well, conservatism. I mean, I don't think it'd be unfair to say that a lot of, you know, America or what people consider great in America came out of like, you know, certain conservative ideals. It came out of the family system, you know, the nuclear family, the heteronormative nuclear family. And, you know, so, okay, so we should be, you know, continually pushing for that goal, right? Like, okay, this is the solution to everything is the heteronormative, you know, nuclear marriage family.
The thing that I have a problem with, and I'm not saying that you do this,
sure,
is it's a problem that I've noticed in my own thinking in the past is like everyone who was old and from yesterday was a fool, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking like, all right, well, there's real challenges at times and even sacrifices. And I'm not saying that people should make sacrifices in maintaining something like a nuclear family. So I'm wondering like why for thousands of years – did people do it? There had to be more than just like the Bible tells us to do it, so we do it.
Well, you can argue that they didn't really do it in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But why has it been something that society prioritized? And I don't know the answer. I mean, I really don't know why this unit – I understand why this unit is important today to conservatives, even to a lot of libertarians, because mm-hmm. – It's a kind of guardian against the state, you know.
I mean, that's what they think.
Well, a healthy family could be that, right? An unhealthy family can be a gateway mm-hmm. to the state,
sure.
as we've talked about on my show a bunch.
Sure.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this unit as in a definitive and like, you know, final way. It can be a positive force. It can be a negative force. I'm wondering, like, as I look at a lot of traditions – not from the way I used to look at things as a young leftist or even a libertarian and say, God, everyone was so unenlightened. Mm-hmm. I say, why? Why was this important? Why did people think, you know, that these traditions were like essential building blocks that had to be protected and had to be maintained? And, you know, I just want to see what kind of information I can get from that because, yeah, I'm not – like the nuclear family is the only way for people to live – that doesn't really resonate with me.
Well, I think something to consider, like with these traditions we're talking about, particularly like marriage, okay? Mm-hmm. Love being a part of marriage, I think the evidence stands that that's a pretty new phenomenon.
Yeah.
Like that's very new. Okay. So I can agree that there is a reason that these things existed, but it has nothing to do with the modern narrative of what these things are. You know, I can agree that there's a reason marriage existed, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago. But that's not when someone talks about defending marriage and then they go for a historical context within which why you need to protect it. Marriage today is not marriage 200 years ago.
Absolutely.
It's not at all. You know, I mean, because people like to appeal. They like to do this, you know, this grand appeal of, well, I think I brought this up in a previous episode. But
I'm doing it. Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, well, just like saying that.
Institution.
Well, just that like, oh, you know, well, you know, women used to be treated very well and everything. Yeah, but it's because they weren't considered human. They were considered property.
Right.
Okay. And no, I don't think any woman is okay with that today. You know, so like all of these concepts, all these traditions that people are talking about that need to be preserved. And again, the problem with saying they need to be preserved, if they like it today and they want to run with it today, that's fine. But their reasons that they give for why these things need to be preserved are usually brought under a historical context. But it's a historical context that has no evidence behind it. It's not there. You know, like the idea, well, this is love and you know, this is what a family ends up looking like. And it's like, well, but that's not what a family ends up looking like, you know, at all. Or that's not what a family looked like, you know, back then, you know, even just 100 years ago or something like this. And I mean, you know, when you get into some of the dirtier stuff that keeps getting found in people's journals and everything, I mean, people had mistresses right and left. It's an argument. I mean, like monogamy is probably something that's only existed for 50 years, you know, in my opinion. I mean, you know, based upon what I see. And so that's where my issue, you know, with attacking a lot of these values and everything is like and people putting up these values as being solutions against the state, kind of like what you described.
Yeah, there's a hypocrisy in that because people can't even uphold the values they claim to value.
No, right. And again, these are so I think like, again, love and marriage is such a new concept. I dare argue that monogamy on a widespread level is a relatively new concept. You know, where's your proof that this is a solution against the state? You know, and we're like, were there healthy families? And I mean, like the family thing is just an easy, it's kind of low hanging fruit in my opinion, because that's the one that gets brought up as the solution for the state. And it's like, yeah, but we've had families for thousands of years. The state's been there the whole time. Like if I could make the argument that, well, what if the family is what props up the state?
I think I think you can make that argument. And I think that the libertarian argument is actually more of a conservative anti-Marxist argument about the family. Mm-hmm. Like Marxists didn't like the family. You know, like Marx destroyed religion, destroyed the family, destroyed
right.
property.
Right.
Because the family was a promoter of inequality, right? Like you could be born, you could be Ivanka Trump.
Yeah.
You know, and then you start, you know, 50 steps ahead of, you know, Ivanka Jones.
Sure.
You might not even get to be named Ivanka if you're from the Jones family. So that is a perpetuator of inequality. That matters what goes on in that family system,
yeah.
You know, it either being a check against the state or a gateway to the state. You obviously can't say that definitively about the family.
Yeah, it depends on like what type you're even talking about. And
there's hierarchy. There's a lot of hierarchy in some families, especially like the Christian concept of like there's a clear hierarchy of like man, wife, child, right?
Which has been a problem for children and for women. Yeah.
Right. And I do, to their credit, I hear libertarians making that argument quite a bit too. And so then we see things like people, you know, getting interested in peaceful parenting and family systems that differ from that authoritarian model of parenting, at least.
Right.
Like I see different arguments in favor of the family from libertarians. There's that kind. There's the peaceful parenting type. And then there's the, oh, well, we're going to have a strong family to keep the state out and it should be a family matter. And it might be an authoritarian family, but it's better than the state.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with this guy, Dave DeLugas. Parents USA is the website. And they try to help families protect themselves against schools.
Sure.
And CPS. I just wanted it read into the record. Like I was kind of doing research on, you know, what's up with this college age generation today? Is it a product of helicopter parenting? And I came across his website and I heard an interview that he did. So I had a conversation with him on Thursday, but there was a lot of landmine. It was a real minesweeper game, you know, like don't click here, Because he said, you know, and I did want to get into those topics, unschooling, peaceful parenting. And he said, I'm in favor of all those things. But, you know, I'm interested in defending parents from constitutional violations as long as they're not hurting their children. You know, and that was like as much as I could get him pinned down on anything. And it's probably a good thing that he's out there. You know, I would say, oh, well, you don't want to do home education and peaceful parenting across the board. Then I'm not going to tell anybody about your organization. You know, because there's probably people who could really use his help. You know, they're litigators. So he kept talking about the Constitution. And I brought that up. And he goes, well, I'm a lawyer. You know, that's the area that I deal in.
Right.
And then I kind of realized, yeah, okay, there's division of labor here, right?
Sure.
So if people want to talk about the school, tell them about me. And if people have legal problems, I'll tell them about you.
Yeah.
That made sense. But it's a real touchy subject, all of the family stuff.
Well, I want to be clear that, like, I don't care if people have families, they do what they do. I'm not like saying that
right.
don't have a family or that the family is unethical or something like that. Like, that's really not what I'm saying at all. I'm just, you know, it gets a little annoying when you're constantly told, well, what's the solution? How do we end the state? And that's what keeps getting propped up. And I'm just like, you know, stop. Okay. Like that can't be it, because that, you know, disregards so many aspects of the human condition that, that are possible, that are options, that, you know, kind of drives me nuts.
It
so,
can be
just for clarity.
It can be a part of a solution, I think,
sure.
in certain cases. But, you know, I used to say that, I feel like I was kind of taking that cue from Free Domain Radio, that someday we'll have families with our ideas and then we'll pass them to our children. Because, you know, kids are always super cool with just having the same ideas as their parents.
Yeah, nothing wrong with forcing that on them, right?
Well, no, they'll learn it through kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think there is a case to be made.
You're right.
Like
you're right.
Have, yeah. If you create that environment for them, that's the environment they'll want. But obviously, there's no guarantee of that either. What kind of outside influences are they going to have?
Sure.
Well, also, the thing I always have a question about is like. It sounds an awful lot. It smacks of having kids with the specific goal of having them have an ideology, you know?
Yeah, it's very Game of Thrones.
Liberty babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I don't think that's an expectation that you're placing on the kid, right? That they're going to be, they're going to have be an anarchist or something.
It's not the right reason to have a kid to like help libertarian demographics.
Yeah.
But these are a lot of these eugenic arguments are made by identity conscious conservatives.
Sure.
You know, like Gavin McInnes, people call into his show. He's like, you're 38. You're married. Okay. You've been married 3 years. How many kids do you have? One. How many do you think you can have by the time you're 45? How old is your wife? 36. How much longer do you think she's going to be able to have children for? If you don't have three, you're not serious. You know, he'll say that.
Yeah.
He'll say you need three kids to be serious. I mean, he's nuts about. And I don't know if he's like serious. I don't know if he's serious.
How many kids
about
does he have?
Three.
Okay.
So that's how.
Then
he
that's a good.
Standard.
That's a good indicator that he's serious.
Yeah, and he said, yeah, his wife had their last one when she was like 42 or something like that.
Wow, Sarah and Abraham.
But yeah, you hear those kinds of arguments, and that always like I forget who used to always say that, like, libertarian women start having babies. Kokesh, probably. I think
it was a lot
Kokesh.
Of people said that.
Yeah, and I was just like, ew. I don't like that.
Yep. I didn't like it either.
But it's part of a solution. But I always felt like when I hear myself saying that back in the day, kind of just picking up from Freedom Main Radio, which is where I heard it and processed that idea, it's just kicking the can, you know?
Sure.
It is kicking the can. One day we'll live free because.
Well, we won't even. It was,
no,
there'll
no.
be like our grandchildren's grandchildren or something.
Yeah. It's very like a. Royalty, like monarchy kind of.
Yeah.
It is Game of Thrones kind of thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Much.
It's a great analogy.
Yeah. So
I've never seen Game of Thrones, so I don't know.
That's right. We're never going to.
Okay. Not putting up any argument there.
Now, I was just interested in, because I noticed that you have a lot of, I don't know what the word is, like towards the West. And I wonder what you see in its place. I guess
I see. Well, you know, this is something I actually talked about this on my show, Sovereign Tech, in response to Empathon that mm-hmm. we did, because like you had us in a previous episode, you had us on a horseshoe. And with that horseshoe, like you asked us very kindly, you asked Stephanie and I, you know, where do you see yourselves on this on horseshoe theory?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we're kind of like, you know, we're like, yeah, we're towards the left. But like that's within.
But we were mostly in the bottom of the horseshoe in the libertarian voluntarist area.
Yeah.
Right, right. But like, you know, and a lot of people like will put me, you know, just because say I disagree with some of what we've just been talking about, you know, like I don't agree that that's, you know, like this is the end all be all solutions and all this stuff. You know, I get put into, you know, kind of that area of the left or whatever. And where I don't see myself that way at all. Like, I mean, you know, my way of thinking is the same thing. It's like, okay, well, there's good things to take from here. There's good things to take from here. Like Stephanie's been saying, and then put that all together, you know, everything's a remix and, you know, and you go yeah. forward. Are there parts of Western civilization that I guess could be, you know, could be considered a good thing, which is kind of the question you're asking me earlier. Yeah. But a lot of the times those things that are claimed to be a part of Western civilization, there's an Eastern equivalent or there's an ancient equivalent, you know, that I don't see the necessity that is being, you know, proscribed to me. That no, we have to have Western civilization. We have to protect it. This is the only one. This is, you know, this is it. It's this way or the highway. And there's zero precedent for that in my mind. And so, yeah, I just, you know, that's where my posts come from, is that like, what are you talking about? Because when you say we need to protect Western civilization, that very quickly turns into we need a military. We need to go to war. We need to, you know, get into all these protectionist arguments.
Speaking of package deals.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And it's just a matter of time before you end up with what is effectively an army. Now, I know there's lots of people, you know, in liberty thinking that say, well, you can have private armies. I totally disagree with that. You know, like, no, you cannot. So, but, and that's where I see a lot of this going. Whenever you're talking about like that, there's this abstract notion, this abstract, honestly, collectivism, like the idea of Western civilization. All I see is kind of, you know, tyranny coming down the road. And again, also everything that they're saying, I see no historical precedent for. I don't see their argument does not stand up to the evidence that is readily available, you know, for people to find.
Yeah, I've kind of struggled with this question because I don't want to be an apologist for the various horror shows that came with the West, but recognizing like there are benefits, and also this is kind of like the prevailing like supraculture of most of the world.
Sure.
So we didn't get the option of, for whatever reason, Asian culture. You know, the modern world is kind of built on the West. The civilized modern world is built on Western values, for better or for worse.
Right.
And the for better people are saying, well, nothing is perfect, but beats the alternative.
Sure.
But you do have to deal with the package deal part of it that a lot of libertarians really shouldn't like and really shouldn't just tacitly accept.
Yeah.
So it's a really difficult question. I think maybe we could do like a part two of this. Is that okay?
Like next time or this time?
No, like next time. Like maybe I could come up to your place sometime and we could do this.
Okay, sure.
I'm just kind of like on a tight.
I'm getting a little sleepy myself. But yeah, I thought we were going to end it. But we could continue.
Part two.
Yeah, because there's probably like we could take some questions. And
I think we had questions that we didn't even get to.
No, we didn't get to them.
Yeah.
Well, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm game.
All right. Cool. So yeah, well, none of this will be in the show anyway.
Country music singers have always been a real close family. But lately, some of my kinfolk have disowned a few others than me. I guess it's because I kind of changed my direction. Lord, I guess I went and broke their family tradition. Get on me, want to know, Hank, why do you drink? Hank, why do you roll smoke? Why must you live out the songs that you wrote? Over and over, everybody made my prediction. So if I get stoned, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition.
This is the ballpark of Brett Stadium.
You need to be a little low.
Tonight, we have the Brett Sox versus the Chicago Bretts. and the Detroit Bretigers.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. This looks good. I can talk loud. And this appears to be fine. All right. So, Brian, you're up.
Talking loud, trying to talk even louder, a little bit, you know, bringing up the pitch a bit. Yeah, talking.